Welcome to History 101, Lecture 13, In Defense of the Enlightenment. In a previous lecture, I argued that the Republica Literae et Christiana of the Middle Ages, during the 16th century, began to shift to a more secularized Republic of Letters, as the unity of Christianity was shattered by the Reformation, and as by 1660, the dividing lines between Protestants and Catholics became more or less fixed. There was virtually no prospect anymore of Catholics converting in numbers to Protestantism, and the other way around, and the religious fervor of the 16th century, therefore, began gradually to run out of steam in what historian Paul Hazard famously called the period of crisis of European consciousness from the late 17th into the early 18th century. This is not to deny the life of people continued to revolve around the church, but as secular and church authorities were so closely linked, wrote the great Jewish philosopher Baruch de Spinoza, in a book in which he openly dared to doubt the veracity of the Old Testament, that made him not only to a bugbear to generations of theologians, but also to the most vilified writer of the 17th century, as we shall see. Quote, "I have often been amazed to find that people who are proud to profess the Christian religion, a religion of love, of joy, of peace, of moderation, and of goodwill to all men, oppose each other with extraordinary animosity, and they give daily expression to the most bitter mutual hatred, so much so that it has become easier to recognize an individual's faith by the latter features than by the former. In searching out the reason for this deplorable situation, I never doubted that it arose because, in the religion of the common man, serving the church has come to be regarded as a worldly career, its unpretentious possessions being seen as lucrative positions, and its pastors are considered great dignitaries. As soon as this abuse began in the church, the worst kind of people came forward to fill the sacred offices, and the impulse to spread God's religion degenerated into sordid greed and ambition. Churches became theatres, where people went to hear orators rather than learn from teachers. Pastors no longer sought to teach, but strove to win a reputation for themselves, and denigrated those who disagreed with them. They did that by teaching new and controversial doctrines, designed to seize the attention of the common people. This was bound to generate a great deal of conflict, of rivalry, and resentment that no passage of time could heal." End quote. Of course, Spinoza was particularly thinking of the tendency of Protestant churches to split into ever more denominations, so many that not even the Protestant congregation itself can nowadays keep them apart, while the Catholic Church of the late 17th century was riven by a schism on the issue of Mary's Immaculate Conception between what Rome called the Jansenist heresy and the official church. There were, to be sure, dreams or ideas to rebuild the shattered unity. Thus, for example, the German Lutheran philosopher and mathematician Wilhelm Leibniz argued for a reconciliation of the Christian churches, if only the Lutherans would recognize the Pope as head of the church, and the Catholics cease denouncing the Protestants as instruments of Satan. But all such attempts made no headway whatsoever. The Catholic and Protestant denominations' positions had become too entrenched in the meantime, aside from which communities having been told for 1.5 centuries that Rome was the devil incarnate, would likely never have accepted it. Indeed, I am probably not far off if I venture to say that in the American Bible Belt, Rome is still Satan incarnate. As the pastors and theologians thus merely agree to disagree and quarrel, in which, if we are to follow Spinoza, they had a vital interest too, the medieval Christian Republic, focused on theology and the law, was reconstituted along 3 other lines that may broadly be called the humanities, the sciences, and the fine arts. In the fine arts, this reconstitution of European unity occurred in several forms. There was music, and particularly there was the new art form of the drama or music, opera, that was invented in Florence and developed by the great Claudio Monteverdi, whose operas are of course still performed, and it was then exported by Italian performers to the courts of the Holy Roman Empire, to France, and by the 18th century to all over Europe and to colonial North America, where everybody particularly loved Handel, not merely his symphonies, but also his 45 operas that had not stood the test of time, as well as have his concertos. And, as many listeners will know, the child prodigy Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart toured from his 4th to his 12th year almost the entirety of Europe, after which the interest in him began to linger. In 1670, the first opera building outside of Italy, the Opéra de Paris, was opened. It was more or less officially sponsored by Louis XIV, so that the first opera performed by court composer Jean-Baptiste Lully, Cadmus Hermione, in 1672, in the middle of Louis XIV's brutal war of aggression against the Dutch Republic, started with the sentence, "The empire over which you, king, rule, is so happy to have you as your master, while it has no wishes to expand." From its royal origins, in a very similar way as the folk, opera began to gradually expand down the social ladder. In the 18th century, it split between opera seria and opera buffa, or in France, vaudeville, that had an increasingly working-class audience from the skilled urban working classes. Mozart's Don Giovanni is opera seria, whilst Die Entführung aus dem Serail is opera buffa, whence too the first opera is in Europe's general language of music, Italian, the second in the local German vernacular. In pictorial art, painting, sculpture, the Renaissance was instrumental in creating 2 new concepts that are typical for Europe, and existed neither in Muscovy nor in China or India, namely a cleft between the arts, without a capital letter, producing tapestries, furniture, and so on, and art with the capital A, producing paintings or statues. And mere popular art slipped ever more downwards, and a distinction arose between the craftsman and the solitary, preferably lonely, genius of the artist. The craftsman was unmistakably working class. The artist occupied a somewhat peculiar position in that he worked with his hands, like the laborer, but was in daily contact with upper-class aristocrats or churchmen, and he could thus ascend beyond his class. By way of contrast, though the golden age of Islam was also the great age of Islamic miniature paintings, for many of those artists we do not even have a name, since making paintings was not rated any higher than making carpets or fine swords, whereas the great Russian painter Andrei Rublev, a contemporary of both Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, and surely no less a genius, was rated a craftsman, rather than a fixed, solitary genius, so that we know virtually nothing about Andrei Rublev, while Michelangelo was a true genius in his self-promotion, too, as he needed to be, because producing art was related to the growth of an international market for art that was closely linked to both the Italian Renaissance and the commercial transformation of the 16th century, and that was indeed every bit as capitalist as the demand for spices or slaves. Thus, for example, in the early 16th century, Antwerp carved altar pieces, paintings, tapestries, books, and other luxury items were exported to an area that stretched from the Baltic to the Mediterranean. The key development that explains the success of Antwerp as an export center for the arts was not only the strength of its economy and the artistic tradition of the southern Netherlands, but specifically a shift from ordering artwork on commission to production for the open market. Antwerp artists were inclined to produce art on specification, and consequently, art was commercialized at a very early stage, and it became the subject of intense trading. Art was made in small proto-industrial workshops that were engaged in standardized production of popular images, and the sophisticated commercial infrastructure that Antwerp could boast allowed art to be sold wholesale to an international clientele at specialized art sales halls. However, the flourishing of the art market was ultimately a direct result of the increased demand for luxury goods, both foreign and domestic, and Antwerp was the spot where supply and demand for art converged. That booming art market led to an increased commodification of works of art. Art dealers entered the scene, and they further professionalized the art trade during the second half of the 16th century. In painting, this commercialization of art led to a diversification of genres, a form of product innovation that in turn generated new demands. Thus, the themes of paintings began to shift from the almost exclusively religious ones of the Middle Ages to a very broad array of genre paintings, illustrating themes from Greek mythology or even of peasant life, such as the Bruegel paintings. And it evolved towards what became, in the Dutch Republic, specialized painter workshops, who in turn specialized on genre paintings for different markets. Thus, the Ruysdael School specialized in landscapes, the Van der Velde School specialized on ships, and there was even the Potter School that specialized on painting cows, presumably meant for selling to wealthy peasants. Painters thus shifted in the late 16th century from depending primarily on commissions from the wealthy and the powerful to working for a free market, where the handling and the sale of paintings became the job of specialized art dealers and a group of increasingly professionalized connoisseurs who could appraise the value of an object of art. And it shifted from a clientele that mainly consisted of very wealthy merchants, princes, the church, or kings, to a broadly bourgeois clientele, if not, as in the Netherlands, gentlemen farmers and master craftsmen who owned, as we know from inventories, surprising numbers of paintings. In fact, one reason why painters tended to shift to things as painting ships or landscapes was that such traditional themes, as themes from Greek mythology or history, had a threshold in learning. Furthermore, painters, as they shifted to such an increasingly broad clientele, also were operating small industrial workshops, where the master painter basically supervised the work of his apprentices, and only for very prestigious commissions did the work himself. However, for the lower rungs of the art market, your average wealthy farmer or shopkeeper, he had the work done by his apprentices, which he then approved by signing it. The most famous case is Rembrandt van Rijn's workshop. We insisted on working for the open art market rather than on commission. As listeners may know, Rembrandt painted one single painting on commission, The Night Watch, and that painting was a disaster. The Amsterdam militia complained it was too big for the room in which they wanted to hang it, whether Rembrandt couldn't saw off part of that painting. So Rembrandt had, as we would now say, to mind targets, the bottom line, and he had to complete work on tight schedule. So that many, if not most, works of Rembrandt were actually made by his apprentices. And art historians have been wrestling ever since what is genuinely Rembrandt and what is merely work from his studio. Thus, by the late 17th century, there had arisen an international art market, Europe-wide and indeed increasingly worldwide. Famous examples are Thomas Jefferson's Monticello estate, that he filled with such paintings as he could cheaply buy in the London art shops, or, on a surely completely different level, the 224 Dutch and Flemish paintings Catherine the Great obtained from a Berlin art dealer in 1764. Those were intended to demonstrate Russia's position as a newly civilized country, and they were, of course, the core of the Hermitage collection. Russian agents purchased ever more later on, as the economy of the Netherlands collapsed after the French occupation in 1795. Or again, the early activities of the first Governor General of Dutch Brazil, Maurits van Nassau, who brought two painters with him, Albert Eckhout and Frans Post. Frans Post painted a large number of Brazilian genre paintings that are nowadays the pride of the Museum of Fine Art in Sao Paulo. However, bringing European artists over was obviously expensive, and hence, in Mexico, the missionaries had already been training Indians in executing European-style paintings in the early 16th century. They were shown pictures of Flemish and Spanish paintings on altar screens, which they were then taught to precisely imitate, so that Mexico, by the 17th century, witnessed a modest flourishing of local paintings, though the painters there remained very dependent on metropolitan taste, and they were hampered by having to depend for patronage almost exclusively on the church, as there was almost no international demand for their painting. The Dutch East India Company was a modest collector of art too, and by the late 18th century it imported increasing numbers of European paintings and handbooks into Japan, such as a Dutch work on painting, Gerardo Lares's Het Grote Schilderboek, that was carefully studied by painter Shibai Kokan, who wrote a book about a new painting, Sayabadan, on Western painting, in which he argued, "Picture that does not represent reality faithfully is no picture at all. No technique other than that of the West can achieve that. When a Western artist looks at the work of an Eastern artist, he would look at it as the work of a child. But when an Eastern artist looks at a Western work of art, he calls it another genre, perspective painting. This is a complete misunderstanding of Western painting." One of his followers, incidentally, was poet and painter Katsuhiko Okusai, whose westernized woodcuts were to entirely transform Western art itself. They were admired by such painters as Charles Monet, exactly for what Shibai Kokan abhorred in it, the not lifelike painting and the stripping down of landscapes to its barest essentials. Now, to pursue with fine art, if it comes to literature, those artists obviously hampered by the medium of the national language, with the gradual withering of Latin as the common European language. Dante and Petrarca were in their time Europe-wide celebrities, but they were known only as scholars of Latin, rather than from their youthful indulgences in the native Vulgate, which nobody in the rest of Europe knew or cared to know, and by which they are, of course, now remembered. The universities continued to stress teaching and schooling in Latin into the 18th century, and indeed, science continued to be written in Latin until the mid-18th century. The first exception to the rule that works of scholarship had to be written in Latin was, in French, the work of René Descartes, and in German, those of Immanuel Kant. And one reason why Kant is so abstrusely difficult is that he had to wrestle with his German. He had to invent new German words where so far merely Latin words existed. However, the training for merchants at broadly senior high school level tended from the 16th century on to stress increasingly practical knowledge, bookkeeping, mathematics, and modern languages. That meant French and some Italian. English, by contrast, was considered a barbaric language that nobody in the rest of Europe knew. Where it may comfort English-speaking listeners to know that no lesser a person than Frederick the Great still said he spoke German only with his horse. The consequence of this, by comparison to painters' small market, was that writers led a rather precarious life into the 18th century. They had either to dispose of a substantial fortune already, such as the Dutch poet Pieter Cornelis van der Hooft, who was a very wealthy urban magistrate, or they had to have some other business, such as Dutch national poet Joost van der Vondel, who was a silk trader, or they had to be exceptionally skilled entrepreneurs, such as Shakespeare, who was obviously a very exceptional and gifted theatre operator. Otherwise, they had to subsist on royal patronage, a very uncomfortable situation that is classically sketched in a play by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, was only too aware of the perils of such a patronage relationship. Torquato Tasso, for printing, was already in the 16th century both a big and risky business. And in the 16th century already, authors got paid only uncertain dividends on their author's right. Very few people could manage to live from writing alone, for their publishers habitually pocketed the proceeds of their sales. A major publishing house, such as Plantijn in Antwerp, had 80 employees by the 16th century's terms, a gigantic enterprise, who published some 1,000 books, half of which were sold in the Low Countries, the rest all over Europe and in the Americas. In the 17th and 18th century, publishing was no gentleman's game. It was a kind of brigandage, where both publishers and authors told the public everything that could sell books, as most books had only meager sales. David Hume's first book, for example, A Treatise Concerning Human Understanding, nowadays recognized as a classic of philosophy, to the dread of countless students, was dead-born at publication, as Hume later complained, and as the student will immediately grasp. And on advice of his publisher, Hume later on wrote different works to put himself in a market where he could sell better. In particular, his History of England was a reasonable success. The publisher, however, still complained it was far too long. Nonetheless, the History of England could still be encountered on the table in any lady's drawing room.
Yet only the fact that French was taught and spoken all over Europe allowed writers to live entirely of their publications. And then only in the 18th century, one of them, Voltaire, became actually quite rich from the sales of his books. Another one, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, more or less managed, for though his books were bestsellers, he had the nasty habit of always quarreling with his publisher. Another one, Denis Diderot, scantily managed, until being allowed a discreet pension from Ladmire. Catherine the Great. And what above all attracted readers were books that had a whiff of illegality about it, either, obviously, with pornographic content, so that Diderot made his living mainly by writing what would nowadays be called soft porn, and did his day job editing the Encyclopédie mainly with what he earned from selling pornography. Some of that period's soft porn indeed now belongs to world literature, such as the general Pierre Laclos's Les Liaisons Dangereuses. Worse, what readers also liked were atheist writings, including Spinoza, whose work could surely only be sold under the counter of the bookshop, or for the worst porn and atheism by travelling co-porteurs who had their books under their overcoats. Much as dirty pictures were still being sold in Europe 60 years ago, so too a co-porteur might then pull a copy of Spinoza's Ethica from under his overcoat. What finally sold were all kinds of salacious books about the high and mighty. By 1780, there was a whole sequee of books on sale on, say, the sexual debaucheries of Queen Marie Antoinette. And it has been argued that by the late 18th century, this began to pull the rug under the French monarchy. Monarchs were increasingly seen as laughable or pathetic, and at best as simple family fathers. One of the oldest ceremonies of the French monarchy had been that, as the king was conceived to possess a kind of magic fluidum, he could cure people by laying his hands on the sick. That ceremony had been performed since the year 1000, but in 1750, Louis XV quietly ceased doing so, as even his humblest subjects now saw it as baloney. Outside of France, writers had to manage very soberly, or they had to have a previously more remunerative career. With the exception of playwright Gotthold Lessing, who more or less managed with his theatre company, most German writers had a different career. Goethe was a lawyer, Friedrich Schiller was a doctor, Novalis was a mining engineer. Ken, the, I would argue, perhaps together with Euler and Kant, greatest mind of the Enlightenment, the great Neapolitan philosopher Giambattista Vico, had to scrape a miserable living as a private teacher. Admittedly, he lived in a place of which the king proudly said, "All my subjects are completely ignorant. It's my task to keep them so, and look, they are so happy." So that Vico indeed faced an uphill struggle against the general indifference and stupidity of his surroundings. Nonetheless, authors enjoyed an increasing circle of readers by the late 17th century from a clique of reading societies that congregated weekly or monthly to discuss the fine letters and new developments in the arts, and mostly in the sciences too. These were initially made up mostly from members of the bourgeoisie, both traders and small-town nobles of the robe. But by the late 18th century in England, there were also some from artisans and for the skilled working class too. As in England, they, by 1760, were by and large literate. And there were even some literate farmers too, though farmers mostly read practical fare. And only one enlightened writer, who was much poorer than either Diderot or Laclau, and thus had to write mostly hard porn for a living, Retief de Laberton, was a peasant story. Books were namely expensive. Amongst the working class of Paris, less than 15% had any book, and the easiest way of obtaining them was spreading the money to purchase them across a group of people. Everybody could become a member of such a reading society after paying a certain entrance fee. So that in principle, all the various better sorts of people, as they said in the 18th century, mingled there. This whole thing was topped by the very aristocratic salons of Paris, that mostly revolved round aristocratic ladies, since they had, after all, servants to do anything for them, were mostly boring themselves to death, and could in private circles then spew forth lofty thoughts, though women themselves becoming authors was still disproved of. Madame Lambert was said to make and break the career of a French academic, whereas the idea of the encyclopedie was originally concocted at Madame de Lespinasse's salon. A very similar role was played by the small provincial courts in Germany, particularly, of course, the Weimar, a midget kingdom of the size of Liechtenstein, or your average Parisian suburb, so that the rulers of Weimar were indeed not much wealthier than the aristocrats convening in the Paris salons. Indeed, they were probably poorer. The book by the French author diffused all over Europe, over North America, somewhat in South America, and the European settlements in Asia. By the 1770s, bestseller writer Jean-Jacques Rousseau, best known for his pedagogic novel La Nouvelle Héloïse, was already being pestered by heaps of fan mail from all over Europe, including the inevitable heaps of marriage proposals from overardent female readers. It was really for those reading circles who found Hume's essay still a bit stiff that a new kind of genre, the novel, emerged. It evolved from a merger of two different genres, the fantastic voyage and the book in the form of letters. The novel gradually replaced the very typical aristocratic genre of the heroic poem. This network of readers, by 1700, covered most European countries, and it has played a particular role in Germany. Politically divided in 235 different political entities, by 1750 it was united by a network of reading societies who more or less all read the same books. Here marketed at the Frankfurt Book Fair, still world's biggest. Germany thus became a cultural nation before it became a political nation. This network of readers had some ties with communities in the Ottoman Empire too, for while the Turkish and Arab communities were not very much in touch with the European world of learning, there was by 1700 a large Greek Orthodox and Armenian merchant community resident in Western and Eastern Europe. They had established printing presses there and kept their families in the Ottoman Empire, and even in the Safavid Empire, abreast of new developments in European literature and science. Thus, for example, the father of modern Greek literature, Adamantios Korais, son of a merchant under Dutch protection in Izmir, and sent to his father to Amsterdam on business. Next he studied medicine in Montpellier. Aside from that, the Greeks also had a small window on the west in the Ionian, for as the Ionian islands had remained Phoenician possessions, there were opportunities for studying in Italy. The University of Bologna in particular featured a large expatriate Greek community. and European literature similarly filtered into Serbia via Rakuša, and, as I said in the earlier lecture, had a thoroughly Italian culture, and was more or less independent from the Ottoman Empire. The national epic of Serbia and Croatia, Osman, by Rakušin senator Ivan Kundulic, from 620, was thus patterned on the epic of Torquato Tasso, Gerusalemme Liberato. Obviously, the circuit of readers included the Caribbean as well. Now, the Caribbean was not much of a reader's place, but people did own some books, and Toussaint Louverture picked up most of his ideas for such enlightenment tracts as he could obtain from his master's library, including, and very unfortunately for his master, the Abbé Reynald's fiercely anti-slavery book, another under-the-counter book, History of the Establishment of the Europeans in the Two Indies. Colonial Americans, and particularly New England, with its very long winter, were avid readers. Basically, what London read, Boston and Philadelphia would read 4 months later, and read it. For in the 18th century, colonial America was amongst the most literate societies in the world. It seems reasonable to assume that, excepting the slaves, and most women of course, males could read and write, though books, that had after all to be imported all the way from London, were expensive, and most people could merely afford the Bible. Colonial America had this almost from the very beginning, an active press. The first press there was established as early as 1638. In the 17th century, North American presses published 445 items. In the 18th century, 2,450, though most of them were short leaflets of only a few pages. Books printed in North America consisted of almanacs, full of practical data for farmers or fishermen, and above all, religious tracts. The publishers there had soon enough found out nothing would sell unless it had some religious twist. The best-sold publication in North America was the New England Prayer Book. Practically the same could be said for Spanish America, where the output of books was largely confined to devotional tracts, and where furthermore, books were always under tight scrutiny by the Inquisition. Indeed, the Inquisition searched all cargo and all luggage of any ship that departed to the Americas on whether it was not carrying any books on the index of the Catholic Church. The same was the case in Brazil. In Portugal, in fact, book controls were so stringent that foreign captains often complained their cargoes got delayed because it had all to be searched for forbidden books. Nonetheless, copies of such outrageous books as Emile or Montesquieu's Lettres Persanes immediately prohibited by the church and they had to be smuggled into Brazil, did still circulate in such places as Rio de Janeiro or Minas Gerais. Nonetheless, by the late 18th century, as both in Spain and Portugal, the crown began to increasingly object to the powers of the Inquisition, the jurisdiction of which the crown complained infringed far too much on its own jurisdiction, some reader circles emerged as well. Though South America lacked the highly articulate public sphere of North America. Now from this collaboration between print capitalism, booksellers and authors, more or less always courting illegality, arose in the course of the late 17th and 18th century of what German philosopher Jürgen Habermas called public sphere between the state and the official church's one, and the private sphere. That private sphere was increasingly sheltered from the view of outsiders. Though, this obviously mainly means the bourgeoisie, as the life of the king was very public, Louis XIV had famously a whole bunch of courtiers standing around him while he solemnly went to sleep or dressed himself as he stood up. Peasants and workers had insufficient space to have a private life. Even sex there had to be done in the presence of at least the children and often other peasants. However, amongst the bourgeoisie, the women by 1700 now had their own separate boudoir, where the men had their drawing room, a man-only or a women's-only space. That the woman or the man in the house was not to enter, and neither were outsiders, except the ubiquitous servants, of course, but they were seen as part of the furniture. And this public sphere was increasingly separated from the sphere of the church and the state. Here, in this public sphere, a reading public freely discussed the state as much as of science and letters. Jürgen Habermas further argues this public sphere is a unique intermediary stage between the medieval and the Reformation situation, where the public discussion was dominated by the church, and the modern situation, where it is dominated by corporate media. Though, admittedly, to some extent, the internet has created a new public space. However, a new public space that is far more privatized than that of the 17th and 18th centuries. On the internet, admittedly, everybody can say what he likes, but the people who are listening to you are likely people who already agree with you. Critical to the evolution of the public sphere were two innovations of the late 17th century, the café and the newspaper. For, argued one of the first English newspapers, the Tatler, on what the function of a newspaper was to be, "This paper shall be intended for the use of private persons who are so public-spirited as to neglect their own affairs and look into the transactions of state. Now, as these persons are for the most part persons of weak intellect, it is necessary to offer them something whereby they be instructed what to think. That shall be the purpose of this paper." The newspaper originally evolved from newsletters used by merchant firms to transmit weekly or monthly information on prices by the foreign correspondents of a firm. Those commonly included some information on local politics too, and on the weather. That was a far more important thing in the age of the sailing ship or the coach than it is for people who work in and commute by car to an office nowadays, and yet it's still the only news most people follow. As this information was of general interest, those newspapers began to appear in print by 1590, originally merely a few pages that later on began to expand to 10 or 20. These were called newsbooks. By the 1690, these newsbooks had evolved into the modern newspaper. Adverts were added on the reverse pages, for products first, and then obituaries, which newspapers soon found could be their main source of revenue. Newspapers were printed in columns and cartoons added in the 1740s. One of the first professional journalists, Daniel Defoe, of Robinson Crusoe fame, which actually he claimed corresponded exactly to real facts until the very end of his life, already thought he had a completely impossible profession, since he sighed, "Nothing is more common than that two men tell the same story quite different from one another, both being eyewitnesses to the event, so that 18th century newspapers habitually made up events. But at any rate, by 1740, they mostly were filled with deaths, executions, and discoveries of the most unheard of villainies, as it was said at the time, which, at the same time, already were sold on the street corners by hawkers, and murder, then as now, always sold best. And this public sphere, argued Immanuel Kant, was also exactly what was meant by the phrase enlightenment, which Kant defined as follows. Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-incurred immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's own understanding without the guidance of another. The motto of enlightenment is therefore, have courage to use your own understanding. Laziness and cowardice are the reasons why such a large proportion of men, even when nature has long emancipated them from alien guidance, nevertheless gladly remain immature for life. For the same reasons, it's all too easy for others to set themselves up as their guardians, for it is so convenient to be immature. If I have a book to have understanding in place of me, a spiritual advisor to have conscience for me, a doctor to judge my diet for me, and so on, I need not make any effort at all. I need not think, so long as I can pay. Others will soon enough take the tiresome job over for me. And now, though we may fond ourselves nowadays on our enlightenment, it is by no means so easy or so self-evident for moderns as we think. For just consider, how many people are nowadays more than happy to have the media pundits, the party, the corporation, or indeed the church, think for them? There are, after all, 600,000 clergymen in the USA alone, who still have to think what the church thinks, lest being considered a heretic. And then there still they are. In other words, enlightenment was the public discussion of affairs of state, the church, or of science by a reading public acting in a capacity of free persons, for argument. Whereas a priest or a soldier must ex cathedra, or in the barrack, follow the will of the church, and expound the will of the church, or that of his superiors, he is at liberty to voice his own opinion once he is speaking as a private person. Now, as I said already, by itself the Enlightenment was embedded in the societies of art that had existed since the 15th century, and in the societies for the advancement of scientific knowledge that had been founded in the 17th century. What the Enlightenment, however, did was to create a separate set of people, the intellectuals, or the flea-floating intelligence, as German sociologist Karl Mannheim called them. They were, and are, on the one hand different from people working at universities, who are voicing, if speaking or writing ex cathedra, the scholarly or scientific consensus, and were, and are bound, by university rules as well. So that in a way, they are but workers, producing education and some non-material goods. On the other hand, they are different from journalists, who have to voice the view of the newspaper, lest their articles be pruned by the editor, or of priests, who have to voice the view of the church,
lest they be expelled from it. Intellectuals are people who address the public as private persons in their capacity as private, which may, or so one at least hoped, allow them to transgress narrow class interests and class views. And they are arguably bound to an age in which the diffusion of and the discussion on knowledge primarily went by way of printed media, and in which a large enough slice of the public were able to read these media, so that the intellectuals in writing could also hope to influence policy making. Intellectuals thus existed in a period roughly extending from 1700 to the 1960s in Europe and the United States, until really the mass diffusion of color TV. By contrast, argues one of the few remaining acknowledged public intellectuals in France nowadays, Régis Dupré, now that public opinion is dependent on TV time, the media, argues Dupré, run on personality, not the collective, the sensation, not on the intelligible, and on the singular, never on the universal. Whereas TV journalists above all value somebody, quote Dupré, who is able to speak brilliantly about a topic about which he knows absolutely nothing. And the less he knows about the topic, the more it's valued. So that academics have nowadays to speak about football on TV, and soccer players are lecturing to academics. Nor is it perhaps a coincidence that the last place which still has a class of public intellectuals in the Enlightenment style, seen as both critics of and moral anchors or lodestars of society, since most of the people could read, but TV was not yet widely diffused, until very recently, was Latin America. Men like Gabriel García Márquez and Eduardo Galeano on the left, and Mario Vargas Llosa on the right, revered and respected throughout the continent, and any few of whom was discussed in the press throughout the continent. And that the first two had died, and the last one is now 79, proves that TV, since the 90s, has made its triumphal entrance into Latin America as well. The public intellectuals are there too replaced by TV presenters and telenovela stars. So the intellectuals of the Enlightenment, to return to the 18th century, a Voltaire, a Rousseau, a Diderot, or in Germany, Gottfried Lessing, though intellectuals had much more difficulty to subsist as individual authors there than the Frenchmen, whereas the Scottish Enlightenment was largely drafted from academia, those intellectuals piggybacked upon both the humanities and the sciences that were practiced in the universities, and they shared its value of free inquiry or rigorous subjection to criticism of established views. But as they were a free-floating group of individuals, they were, as it were, addressing the public over the head of academia. And that's something which academia then, as now, resented. About the worst thing one would say in academia about the late Carl Sagan was that he was a popularizer. And similarly so, Isaac Newton, who dabbled most of his time in theological speculations, and actually thought his theology was far more important than those minor contributions he made to the philosophy of nature, as he called it, would have been horrified to find that the, if not atheist, then at least deist Voltaire, proved to be the biggest popularizer of his views in France, while the greatest mathematician of the 18th century, Leonhard Euler, was rather embarrassed with all the praise his fellow mathematician and notorious atheist, the co-editor of the Encyclopédie, D'Alembert, showered on him, as he both detested his atheist views and saw him as a popularizer. We should, therefore, not equate science or scholarship and enlightenment, as the philosophers Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer did in a seminal book that is called The Dialectic of the Enlightened, that is really a criticism of the technocratic use of modern physics rather than of the Enlightenment, as they claim. Now, though there are still a few scholars who are enthusiastic about the Enlightenment, in the present political climate, it is bon ton to criticize the Enlightenment, whether from the postmodernist left or the conservative right, which goes back to Jacob Tolman's still highly influential studies on the origins of what he called totalitarian democracy. In my view, that was written in the 1950s. Those books are a sad example of Cold War screwed historiography. In his view, the Enlightenment consisted of a bunch of foolish intellectuals who wanted to establish a perfect society here on Earth, instead of duly waiting, as they apparently ought to have done, for the 1,000 years Rome of Christ, or for that matter, on the second coming of the Messiah, as of course Talmud was an Israeli. And so the thought of the foolish Enlightenment bunch is said to have ensued in all the horrors of the terror of the French Revolution, and so on. Straightforward to Stalin. For the Enlightenment wanted to impose a utopian rational model or blueprint upon society, and that led straight to all those horrors. Now this is partly undeniable. Socialism stands clearly in the Enlightenment tradition. But so, in fact, do most Western traditions. Above all, Cold War liberalism does, as I shall argue in a later lecture. More importantly, though, it seems that in this respect, Habermas is completely right. The Enlightenment above all believed in and consisted of free discussion, a free discussion that was still repressed by both church and state, and few things were really as distant from it as a totalitarian repression of free thought. Can it is also common to argue the Enlightenment has become by and large irrelevant, since everything it demanded has long been realized, whereas from the left it has been faulted for trying to impose an arrogant colonial project of improvement upon the colonial population. Now the simplest answer to such accusations would obviously be, what Enlightenment? Because the Enlightenment authors really agreed on very little, and they had, as historian Jonathan Israels argues, a radical wing that was, if not straight atheist, then at least agnostic, and wanted to effect radical social reforms, a moderate group that at least thought religion was necessary for public order and monetary reforms to be carried out gradually and a very conservative way that never questioned vested authority. This was actually typical for both the German Enlightenment and the Spanish Enlightenment, the Ilustración, whereas obviously in Russia the Enlightenment was kept on a particularly tight leash by the state. But though that would be the easy defense, there are two things about the Enlightenment that are far too often forgotten and that need to be brought out. First, there were very powerful forces arrayed against the Enlightenment, and those forces were the powers that be too, the feudal law and scholastic thought. Feudal law was the law of the land, and scholasticism was being taught at the universities. People like Voltaire, Rousseau, or Diderot were always acting and writing on the edge of illegality and were constantly pursued by lettres de rais, which could land them in prison. It was very dangerous to be a man of the Enlightenment. Had they wanted to make a career, they would have done better to voice the standing views of the church and of the king. For, after all, the Pope himself condemned the disgraceful writings now circulating in France in 1780, and he ordered the parish priests to immediately burn them and to turn against the wish of the Pope in a Catholic country was very risky. Again, it is easily forgotten that Voltaire's greatest press campaign concerned Jean Calais, tortured and executed because he was accused of having murdered his son on what Voltaire thought were spurious charges, only because he was a Protestant. And that was not because Voltaire was an admirer of Luther, but for the sake of religious toleration, which was by no means allowed in France. And it was a dangerous campaign indeed, as it was directly opposed by the church and by the entire judicial apparatus. Enlightenment intellectuals were thus not simply voicing the common opinion, as most self-styled intellectuals nowadays do, and they ran considerable personal and material risks in not doing so, in contrast to most modern self-styled intellectuals as well. Second, we tend to easily overlook or forget, with this cult of enlightenment by association, how many real abuses and inhumane practices the old regime in France, let alone in Germany or Italy or Poland or Russia, had, that the Enlightenment tried to tackle. For example, the Enlightenment put a definite end to the witch trials that, as even the church itself began to admit by the late 18th century, were a blight on the history of the church. However, that witchcraft was still on the Austrian law code as a crime punishable by death in the late 18th century proves how very necessary all this still was. Then again, the Enlightenment sharply criticized and achieved by the late 18th century the ending of the application of torture during judicial investigation, a common practice in the 17th century. And it also condemned the public execution by means of a horrendous form of torture that had been a common feature of European life for at least 1,000 years or so. And while the Enlightenment could not put a stop to public executions as a form of mass popular entertainment, it at least condemned it. Your efforts longer could, if he liked to, and there were many people who liked to, have witnessed from 1780 to 1820 1,200 people hanged in an atmosphere that one might best describe as of that of a jolly public festivity. Spectacular hangings attracted the kind of crowds of modern football matches. 30,000 to 45,000 people, houses offering the best views, being rented months in advance. Yet in the leading Enlightenment work on criminal justice, Cesare Beccari's Dai Delitti e della Pena, Beccari pleaded for abolishing the death penalty altogether, and he was the first author to ever do so. Yet if people had to be executed, let it then at least be quick. So Dr. Joseph Ignace Guillotin pleaded it be done by the machine that was to be named after him. Then again, European prisons were true caverns of woe that simply belly the imagination, windowless, squalid infernos, whence Enlightenment writers pleaded for larger, better ventilated prisons that were later on realized in the circular prisons of the 19th century. Then again, Voltaire's best known affair as he was young was a quarrel with the aristocratic Duc de Rohan, where the Duke invoked the right for a nobleman to thrash a commoner by a bunch of his cronies. And when Voltaire then protested, to teach him manners, the king had a prison warrant written out for him. While it was partly a personal vendetta, it thus also involved judicially fixed unequal treatment of people by a criminal court. In the 18th century, a nobleman got a much lighter penalty for murder or assault than a commoner. Then again, the Enlightenment thinkers rallied against child abuse. In the 16th and 17th centuries, you weren't considered a good father if you didn't beat your child very often. Whereas Rousseau in Emile pleaded children dealings too, and they should be gently raised rather than constantly beating them. Again, Enlightenment economists such as Jacques Turgot and François Quesnay condemned feudal rights and duties, and above all they condemned serfdom. For they argued, as nobody was proprietor of a piece of land under a feudal system, nobody was encouraged to improve the land too. While under serfdom, it was in the proper interest of peasants to do as little work as possible. In 1783, France abolished the last remnant of serfdom, men mocht. But this was obviously a hot issue in Austria, where proposals of Emperor Maria Theresa were, however, blocked by the Hungarian Estates General, and only her successor, Joseph II, could start with abolishing serfdom. However, the abolition of serfdom was above all a contested issue in the Baltic and in Poland. It led to a heated polemic amongst the German speakers there. Some, such as figure Caroline Merkel, argued that serfdom no longer fitted in the modern age. Others argued, however, it was appropriate for such an Oriental people as the Estonian-speaking fathers. They, after all, were savages, given to idling, cruel, and superstitious uses, and only interested in sex. A good illustration of how this, whether African slavery or Estonian serfdom, tends to produce very similar clichés. And enlightened as they said they were, neither Catherine the Great nor the equally great Frederick II of Prussia, the enlightened model prince, shown playing the flute at his pleasure palace Sanssouci near Potsdam, in the famous 19th century painting that illustrates this episode. Frederick II would never consider abolishing serfdom, for, said Frederick, as the serfs were private property, he could not abolish that institution without touching the principle of safety before the law. It was in a way very typical for Frederick. The legal code he introduced in 1786, the Preußisches Allgemeines Landesrecht, was in some ways very advanced. It abolished torture, for example, yet it would not even consider touching serfdom. However, the most controversial issue the Enlightenment put on the agenda was slavery, since, as we saw, the slave trade reached its peak during the very heyday of the Enlightenment, and the hometown of the Baron de Montesquieu, Bordeaux, was heavily involved in it. All those genteel salons were pretty much financed by plantations, and the moderate faction during the French Revolution, the Girondins, were pretty much a pro-slave trade faction as well, as both the trade of Bordeaux and Nantes depended on the slave trade. Yet, wrote Bernardin de Saint-Pierre, one of the few enlightened writers to have experienced actual slavery, close up, Bourbon Island, the illusion, I am angry those philosophers who speak up courageously have not spoken up about slavery. They turn away as if this crime was not a crime of our time, and not one in which half of Europe has played a part. And indeed, while slavery is sometimes briefly titled crime in the encyclopedia, in general, it preferred keeping a very low profile on this sensitive issue and discussed it merely as an economic. Now, in the light of all this, there seems to be a consensus in literature, in this case both the Franco and the Anglophone literature, that the Enlightenment thinkers did not really care for the slaves, and that the credit for abolishing the slave trade should entirely be credited to the Protestant Church and to the Presbyterians and the Quakers in particular. I don't agree. In my view, slavery was generally condemned by the Enlightenment thinkers, and increasingly by the entire public sphere as well, at least by those people who were not immediately profiting from the slave trade. Yet those opinions were muted because of general censorship, as this was a very sensitive issue. In fact, reader societies, and indeed the public opinion throughout France, and even in the Netherlands, at least for those who had not invested in slavery, and there were obviously lots of them for one safe way of investing for your retirement was in plantation shares, which thousands of people owned. The public opinion was increasingly turning against slavery by the 1770s. Thus, a recent study of the Académie Française noted that for the open writing contests, which the Académie held from the 1750s onward, they were flooded by contributions that condemned slavery in general, and that condemned the slave trade very much in particular. All of them remained unpublished, however, as the Académie thought this was far too difficult an issue. Yet the problem was that French national prosperity vitally depended on Saint-Domingue, and that were slavery to be abolished there, only French competitors would profit. The Marquis de Condorcet, in the first book openly advocating the abolition of slavery, thus thought that rather than abolishing it all at once, it was better to do it gradually, over a long transition period. This was actually what happened later. In this, as in other respects, Condorcet was far ahead of his time. He was also one of the very first to plead for the female suffrage. Yet this was, for 18th century public opinion, when women were generally seen as the weaker vessel, a far too long step. And the reason for that increasing revulsion of the public sphere against the slave trade was obvious. As the trade was booming in the 1770s and 1780s, simply ever more people got exposed to it. In the 17th century, the whole thing could conveniently be tucked away as it evolved with only a few ships and a few sailors. But by the 1770s, slave bracelets were conveniently for sale in your average corner shop in Liverpool or Nantes. And ever more people knew somebody who had actually sailed on a slave ship and had to jettison bodies in the water to feed them to the sharks that pursued those slave ships as a matter of course. But to close off with the view of the Enlightenment on colonialism, here is Kant voicing the true view of the Enlightenment on slavery, on colonialism, and on the colonization of India, which brings us to the topic of the next lecture. The distant parts of the world should come to relate peaceably with one another, in ways that will eventually be covered by laws, moving the human race ever closer to a constitution establishing world citizenship. Compare that idea with the inhospitable conduct of those civilized countries of Europe, especially the ones driven by communes. Their wrong treatment of the land and the people they visit is terrifying. When these Europeans, these civilized intruders, first came upon America, the Negro lands, the Spice Islands, or the Cape, they regarded them as lands without owners, for they counted the inhabitants as nothing. In India, under the pretense of intending to establish trading posts, they brought in foreign soldiers to oppress the natives. They started up widespread wars amongst the various Indian states, and they spread famine, rebellion, treachery, and the whole litany of evils that now afflict mankind. China and Japan Japan, who've had experience with such guests, have wisely refused an entry. China lets them come up to the border, but not to cross it. Japan allows only the Dutch to land on its shores, but it treats them like prisoners. The worst of these, or from the moral point of view, the best, is that nothing was gained from all these outrages, because all these trading companies are on the verge of collapse. The sugar islands in the Caribbean, that place of the most refined and cruel slavery, have produced no revenue, except indirectly and nastily by providing sailors for warships, thus contributing to the conduct of war in Europe. And yet all these atrocities are the work of powers that make a great show of piety and believe themselves the chosen people.